Velkommen til et helt særligt afsnit af Ydom Podcast, hvor vi i dag tænker tilbage på marts måned i år, hvor jeg var så heldig at være inviteret med i den store internationale akutmedicinske podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine af Ken Milne, som jo må siges at være the grand old man, når det kommer til kritisk gennemgang af akutmedicinsk litteratur. Han startede sin blog The SGM i 2012, og han har siden da produceret over 300 podcasts og blogs, hvor han gennemgår relevant akutmedicinsk litteratur. Det var en kæmpe, kæmpe oplevelse, og jeg håber, at vi på Resource-platformen kan efterleve bare halvdelen af, hvad Ken Milne har produceret og kommer til at producere fremad. Studiet, vi gennemgik, det var et studie, der omhandlede spirometri i akutafdelingen, og hvorvidt det kan anvendes til at identificere, hvilke patienter over 65 år med tre eller flere ribbensfrakturer, der er i mindst risiko for at udvikle komplikationer i form af hemotorax, atelektaser, respirationssvigt og behov for indlæggelse på intensiv. Og hvorvidt det er tilfældet, det kan du høre her.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em and street 'em. Today's date is March 17th, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Blow Away, Blow Away, Blow Away, Spirometry for Discharging Older Patients with Rib Fractures. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Emil Iversen. He is an emergency medicine resident at the University Hospital of Zealand, Denmark. He currently serves as vice chair of the Danish Society for Emergency Medicine and chair of the Young Doctors in Emergency Medicine in Denmark. He has a passion for FOMED and is the creator of the Danish EM platform. Welcome to the SGM, Emil.
Thank you so much, Ken. I've been very, very much looking forward to coming on.
Well, this is a live episode of the SGM being recorded over Zoom for the RESUS organization. Can you tell the SGMers a little bit about RESUS?
Yeah, sure. So as you know, emergency medicine is a very new specialty in Denmark. We've actually only had the specialty for 3 to 4 years now. And RESUS is basically an organization created by all of the hospitals in our region to try and sort of catch up on all of the evidence and all of the good standard of care that is out there in the world where you guys have had the specialty for so many years. So we're trying to bring together all of that knowledge on specific educational days that we're having, as well as putting it on our website available to the broader community in Denmark.
Well, we just finished a one-hour presentation on basically science and what it is and what it isn't. We talked about evidence-based medicine and then showed how to do a five-step critical appraisal. But this live recording is going to be a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication trying to cut that KT window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year using the power of social media. Are you ready to go, Emil?
I am, definitely.
Now, before we get too into it, we just discovered that my favorite candy called Double Zoot Black Licorice comes from Denmark. And you have a bit of a story about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, licorice is potentially the favorite meal of the Danes. I'm not sure it was invented in Denmark, although we would like to take that credit, I think. But my Spanish wife, who I've been living with for 10 years now, still refuses to eat salty licorice, although I've tried to convince her that it is just the best thing in the world.
Does your wife like maple syrup?
That definitely. Maple syrup, she's sold on, yeah.
So maybe we could, you know, have a bit of a cultural exchange here. I could be your supplier of Canadian maple syrup if you could be the supplier of black salted licorice. Is that a fair trade?
I would definitely make that trade, yeah.
Excellent. And your wife would be happy.
And there's plenty of salty licorice to go around, so.
All right, let's get started with a case for today's podcast.
Yeah. A 74-year-old woman who suffered a fall earlier today presents to the emergency department and is found to have 5 rib fractures to her right thorax, but no other injury. She's otherwise well and her vitals are stable, but she is in some pain. Recent guidelines recommend admitting the patient to the intensive care unit, but the patient is eager to return home to her husband, who is also well, and whom she claims will be able to help her.
Rib fractures are common injuries among older populations and can potentially lead to life-threatening complications, such as a pneumonia, a pneumothorax, or decreased inspiratory capacity. Some recent guidelines recommend admitting patients older than 65 years of age with two or more rib fractures to an intensive care unit, to an ICU, or they do say you could put them in a other step-down monitored setting.
Currently, patients with three or more rib fractures are often admitted for analgesia and monitoring and subsequently discharged without complications. Some recent retrospective studies have actually suggested that early spirometry may be a useful indicator of prognosis in patients with multiple rib fractures.
Identifying patients with a good prognosis that could be safely discharged home with analgesia could potentially avoid unnecessary hospitalizations. This would likely lower healthcare costs and decrease the risk of hospital-acquired infections.
Now, spirometry includes metrics such as forced vital capacity, FVC, peak expiratory flow, the PEF, forced expiratory volume 1 second, FEV1, and negative inspiratory force, NIF. But the PEF, the peak flow, has not been demonstrated to be closely correlated with patient outcomes.
However, the FVC, the forced vital capacity, has been shown to correlate with patient outcomes and length of stay, or LOS, in patients who have multiple rib fractures. These studies were limited by their retrospective observational nature.
And hand grip strength has also been used to measure overall frailty.
Yeah, and I reached out to my geriatric EM guru, Dr. Chris Carpenter, who's also my BFF, and he's done some work in this area. He published something over 10 years ago. His team found grip strength was weakly correlated with frailty in older ED patients. He said that future research should confirm this association and assess the correlation of grip strength with other measures of frailty, because that's the holy grail of geriatric emergency medicine, is trying to determine the frailty of an individual, because a number is a number. So what their age is, but that's not necessarily how frail they are. We've all seen very healthy and vibrant 85-year-olds, and we've also seen people that were quite frail in their early 60s. There are multiple other authors that have investigated this simple and inexpensive tool, a hand grip monitor, for predicting frailty. And I'll throw some links in the show notes for people to read about. But Emil, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
So what we're trying to examine is, can spirometry testing identify patients 60 years and older with at least three rib fractures who can safely be discharged home from the ED?
And what's the reference?
So we're reading the study by Schuster et al. Called Spirometry Not Pain Level Predicts Outcomes in Geriatric Patients with Isolated Rib Fractures from the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery.
And this was published in 2020. So let's go through the PICO. Now, we talked about the PICO during the EBM presentation, but this is actually a PICO because it has exposure instead of intervention. So what was the population for this group?
They're looking specifically at patients 60 years of age and older admitted to hospital with at least three rib fractures within the last 24 hours.
And so by that inclusion criteria, you can gain that they excluded people who the injury was greater than 24 hours before presentation, anyone who had significant additional musculoskeletal injuries or cognitive impairment, or those unable to cooperate with testing. All of those individuals were excluded from this study. How about the exposure?
So they looked specifically at the spirometry measuring at days 1, 2, and 3, including the forced vital capacity, the forced expiratory volume 1 second, and the negative inspiratory force.
And what did they compare it to?
So they included this measure of frailty that we discussed, hand grip strength, as well as pain assessment through the visual analog scale.
All right, and let's go through the O, and the O stands for outcome. What was the primary outcomes?
So they had two primary outcomes, which were discharge disposition and length of stay.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
They had several of those, and they included mortality, pneumonia, intubation, unplanned transfer to higher level of care, and then lastly, readmission within 30 days.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, spirometry measurements early in the hospital stay predicts ultimate discharge home, and this may allow immediate or early discharge. The impact of pain control on pulmonary function requires further study, end of quote. All right, Emil, we've got a quality checklist for prognostic studies, and this has six questions. The first question is, the study population, did it include or focus on those in the emergency department?
So we've said yes, although the study doesn't specifically say so, it is supposed that these patients were admitted through the ED.
Did the patients represent those with the problem?
Yes. Although patients with significant additional musculoskeletal injury or cognitive impairment were excluded, we feel that these are likely patients who would be admitted in any case.
Were the patients sufficiently homogenous to represent? Were the patients significantly homogenous with respect to prognostic risk?
Yes, and the study did actually adjust the models for things such as age, sex, number of rib fractures, hemothorax, pneumothorax, COPD, pulmonary contusion, and smoking history.
Was it objective and an unbiased outcome criteria used?
So here the answer is yes and no, as the primary outcome criteria were objective and unbiased, as well as patient-oriented. However, some of the secondary outcomes, such as pneumonia, were less objective and potentially more biased.
Was the follow-up sufficiently long enough and complete?
Again, the answer is going to be yes and no. Yes, because the patients were followed up until discharge, and as such, follow-up was sufficient for the primary end goals. However, the 30-day follow-up by chart review for readmission is potentially insufficient for mortality and readmission, such as what if they were admitted to another hospital? That doesn't really, it's not really explained in the paper.
The sixth and final question, Emil, is the effect size, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
So this point is unclear, as the study was underpowered both by preferred standards, minimum 400 patients, and by the initial intent, which was 150 patients. And although the study was able to find a statistically significant odds ratio of forced expiratory volume 1 second for discharge home and length of stay, the difference was only modest, as the odds ratio was 1.03.
Yeah, and we'll get deeper into this idea of powering studies as one of our key nerdy points, because I want to talk about powering of studies. But let's get to the results section. There were 346 patients over the age of 60 admitted to hospital with isolated rib fractures. The exclusion criteria was met in 260 patients, so most of the patients were excluded. This resulted in a cohort of 86 patients. The mean age was 77 years and 50% female. Just over half the patients that were included were admitted to a step-down unit, so not the 100% as suggested for patients 65 and older with two rib fractures should be put in an ICU. Now, 22% were admitted to the ICU in this study and 26% to a surgical floor. The mechanism of injury was fall in just over half the patients. Now, motor vehicle collisions was 45%, but this was interesting. Motorcycle collisions, 1%. The median number of fractured ribs was 5. Pneumothorax was present in 5% and hemothorax in 4%. And in this cohort of 86 patients that were included, one died. What was the key result, Emil?
The key result was higher spirometry values and grip strength were associated with early discharge from hospital.
Yeah, and let's dig into more specifically that primary outcome of discharge disposition and length of stay.
So the authors found a forced expiratory volume of 1 second had an adjusted odds ratio of 1.03 with a 95% confidence interval of quite narrowly 1.01 to 1.06, and the p-value was 0.001.
And when they looked at grip strength, this was also significantly associated with being discharged home. The greater the grip strength, the greater the probability that they would be discharged home.
However, forced vital capacity and negative inspiratory force were not statistically significant.
And pain score, a subjective outcome, was poorly predictive of length of stay. How about the secondary outcomes?
So there were only a few patients that had some of the secondary outcomes of interest. And this included the one mortality, as you mentioned, two pneumonias, one intubation, three unplanned transfer to higher level of care, and then three readmissions within the 30-day follow-up.
All right, Emil. It's my favorite part of the podcast. It's time to talk nerdy to me. You ready?
I'm ready.
And guess how many points I have?
5.
Correct. All right. So the first one is on me. This is about selection bias. All patients were screened except when an investigator was unavailable. We suspect the unavailable was nights, weekends, and holidays. Now, no details were provided in the manuscript of how many of the 260 out of 346. So that's 3/4. That's 75% excluded. How many of those exclusions were due to the reason that the investigator was unavailable? This could have introduced some selection bias into the data.
The second nerdy point is regarding power. As you mentioned, we're going to dive into that a bit more. And there was no formal power calculation done a priori. The authors say a rough estimate to find a difference between the two groups would have been about 400 patients. It's unclear how they arrived exactly at this number. They did estimate a complication rate of about 20% based on the geriatric trauma outcome score, which is calculated by taking the patient's age and adding it to a injury severity score times 2.5, and then adding another 22 if the patient was given packed red blood cells by 24 hours.
Post hoc power calculations really shouldn't be done. It's good practice, however, to do a power calculation a priori to plan your research project. In contrast, though, doing a post hoc power calculation, it can be misleading. It's better just to look at the confidence interval around the point estimate of the results. The results are the results. And looking backwards with a PHP calculation does not help us interpret the results any better. And I'd like to thank Andrew Althaus from Epi Twitter for providing me with a number of citations discussing this issue of doing post hoc power calculations. And I'll put some links in the show notes.
So the third point is regarding blinding, as the investigators in this study were not blinded. And although, as we mentioned, spirometry is a seemingly objective measurement, it does require a significant instructing of the patient. And the fact that the same investigator performed both the pain assessment and the spirometry could have introduced some coaching slash spectrum bias.
Yeah, and when we are using the term bias, we're referring to something that systematically moves us away from the quote-unquote truth. And by truth, we mean the best point estimate of an observed effect size with a confidence interval around that point estimate. Now, Emil, can you tell us a bit more about this coaching spectrum bias?
Sure. So coaching bias could be conscious or it could be unconscious. It could occur when patients who were thought to have higher levels of pain were not pushed as hard to go through with the spirometry.
Yeah, and coaching bias is a form of spectrum bias. Sensitivity of a study depends on the spectrum of disease, while specificity depends on the spectrum of non-disease. So you can falsely raise sensitivity if the cohort included has lots of very sick people and specificity can look great if you have no sick patients in the cohort. And the best resource I've found on understanding the direction of bias in diagnostic test accuracy is a study by Kahn that was published in Academic Emergency Medicine.
And our fourth nerdy point is surrounding the rib fractures. Now, all but four patients included had their injuries identified by CT scan. We know that rib fractures are often missed on initial chest x-rays and actually in up to 50% of cases. And one rib fracture on a chest x-ray is associated with a high risk of multiple rib fractures. So Ken, I'm already wondering whether we're discharging patients with undiagnosed multiple rib fractures.
And that's a good thing to question because we could have denominator neglect. How many people were seen and not suspected of having rib fractures? Had a chest x-ray and it was read as normal, or had a chest x-ray and only had one rib fracture seen, not the required number to get into this study. And there is evidence of this issue actually in the manuscript. The authors did not screen 322 acutely injured patients who were discharged directly from the emergency department. But three of those patients that were not screened to be in the study were believed to have subacute rib fractures by imaging characteristics.
Now, the final nerdy point is about the follow-up in this study. They had their secondary outcomes of pneumonia, readmission, and mortality at 30 days. Very few patients were observed to have any of these outcomes. And perhaps this is because patients could have deteriorated more gradually and these outcomes may not be realized until after 30 days.
Yeah, it would have been nice to see a longer follow-up period to be more confident that these were not delayed at, to be more confident that there were not delayed adverse events. All right, that's enough nerdiness. Let's comment on the author's conclusion and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
Yeah, so we agree that spirometry may or may not aid in the We agree that the spirometry may or may not aid in the disposition of this group of patients to either a monitored or unmonitored setting.
Can you give an SGEM bottom line?
Spirometry represents an interesting prognostic tool for older patients with multiple rib fractures, but we do not have enough high-quality evidence for it to guide us in discharging patients home directly from the ED.
And can you resolve the case that you presented at the start of the podcast?
Sure. So you ensure adequate pain management after thorough history is taken, and you feel confident that the patient understands the importance of efficiently treating her pain and is reliably reporting her pain levels. You perform a spirometry, and the patient's FEV1 is 65% predicted. This provides a baseline, but does not impact your decision to admit her to hospital on a monitored bed with the hope of her being discharged home within a few days.
And how are you going to take this publication and apply it clinically?
So this was a prospective study performed in order to test signals from retrospective studies regarding the usability of spirometry in the prognosis of elderly patients with multiple rib fractures. And the authors managed to verify the results of the retrospective studies and further our beliefs that spirometry could potentially be of use in the early discharge of this group of patients.
But we feel that it's too early to safely discharge this high-risk population directly from the emergency department based on the results of spirometry. Further high-quality evidence is needed to support such action.
Yeah, and hopefully spirometry will prove to be a reliable prognostic tool in elderly patients with multiple rib fractures. Its use could potentially be considered in identifying those patients who do not need to be admitted to the ICU and can likely be discharged home in a few days following adequate pain management.
So what are you going to tell the patient?
So I tell her, you've broken five ribs. This is a very painful injury. We would like to admit you to the hospital for a few days and watch you closely. Things can get worse for a few patients. Broken ribs can cause a collapse of the lung and or bleeding into the lung. This can be a life-threatening complication. However, we can treat this successfully by putting a tube into your chest. Staying for a few days will also allow us to get your pain well controlled.
And for the audience, this is when we do the Keener contest. Now, it's called Keener because in Canada, we refer to those medical students that were very keen, very ambitious, always sat at the front of the class, answered all the questions. I don't know if there's a similar term that's used in Danish society. In the US, these individuals are referred to as gunners. You know, they're gunning for the answers, the questions, the best rotations, the best residencies, and that kind of thing. Emil, is there a term used for those types of people that are very keen, very aggressive, very those types of medical students? Is there some kind of similar term?
I don't think it's as well put as you guys put it, but I think the term would be streber.
Streber?
Yeah. And I know that sounds horrible. It is not necessarily the best word of the Danish language, I promise you. Please don't judge us based on that.
What does it mean? Or will I lose my PG rating on iTunes?
No. So I guess it means someone who strives very, very hard for something.
Okay. Yeah. And anyways, I don't have a Keener contest winner from last week because we are recording this in advance. But I'm going to ask you, Emil, to give a Keener contest question for this week's episode.
Definitely. So the Keener contest question for this week is, what is the main driver of hypoxemia in patients with flail chest and paradoxical motion of the chest wall?
Well, if you know the answer to this week's Keener contest question, it's simple. Send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, we've started a continuing medical education program with the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. This is one way to support this FOMED project. We will keep producing this free open access medical education content. So the content will always be free for anyone at any time for no price. But if you do want some CME credit for it, there is a small fee, and I'll put a link in the show notes. Well, thank you, Emil, for inviting me to give virtual grand rounds to your Danish Society of Emergency Medicine. I really enjoyed it. And then coming on the SGEM and being a guest skeptic to do a structured critical appraisal of this recent publication.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, the final aspect of doing an SGEM episode is to get the guest skeptic to read the tagline. And I need you to do it in your thickest Danish accent.
So I'll give it a go. We had a foreign minister a couple of years back who was very unfortunate in one of the climate conferences, caught saying something like, the ice is melting at the poles, in a very horrible Danish accent. So I'll see if I can live up to that.
Well, before you do that, let me just say that your English is phenomenal compared to my non-existent Danish. So just lean into it and give it your all.
I'll give it a go. Thank you. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. How was that?
That was beautiful. That was fantastic. It's sort of like me doing the Canadian hoser, eh? Take off, eh? Your hoser. Talk to everyone next week. And that is how we make some FOMED magic, everybody. That is how we do the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Det var ordene fra min oplevelse med at optage podcast med Ken Milne. Og selvom det foregik digitalt over Zoom, så kan jeg sige, at ordsproget om ikke at møde din helte bærer på ingen måde vand. Ken Milne har længe været mit helt, helt store idol, og nu, 5 måneder efter, at vi optog podcasten, kan jeg stadig ikke få armene ned. Har du også fået blod på tanden og blevet interesseret i, hvad Ken Milne kan, så kan jeg på det kraftigste anbefale, at du går ind på hans hjemmeside www.dsgem.com. The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine er en uundværlig ressource for enhver akutmediciner, og du vil på derinde kunne finde uendelige mængder af højkvalitets kritisk gennemgang af vigtig akutmedicinsk litteratur. Så jeg håber, at du har nydt afsnittet. Og som altid, hvis du har ros, ris eller kommentar til afsnittet, så hører vi meget gerne fra dig. Du er velkommen til at skrive til os inde på hjemmesiden www.akutmedicineren.dk, hvor du kan finde en kontaktformular, eller skrive direkte til os på akutmedicineren@gmail.com. Tusind tak, fordi du lyttede med.